This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Who riots and who loots? It might not be criminals looking for a pretext, but legitimate protesters who go too far.
Populations who are feeling marginalized, younger people often lack the institutional channels that older people have, people who are from marginalized groups.
Hear from an Illinois Wesleyan scholar about how people can go over the edge. Plus an update from the United Way of McLean County on food, housing, and child care assistance. And you'll hear another episode in our Living Black and Bloomington Normal series. After a WGLT news update, this is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County health officials announced 6 new coronavirus cases today. That brings our total number of active cases up to 49, with 2 people hospitalized and the rest isolating at home. The county has seen a 15% increase in cases in just the past 8 days. There was a bit of good news. Our testing positivity rate declined for the second straight day. It's now 2.2%, and that's below the state and national averages. Attorney General Kwame Raoul has filed a lawsuit on Illinois State University's behalf opposing a new federal rule that could make it harder for international students to stay in the U.S. The Trump administration regulations would prohibit foreign students from staying in the country if their college operates entirely online this fall because of the coronavirus. DeLay's lawsuit seeks an injunction to stop implementation of the new rules. It's part of a multi-state lawsuit that includes several other Illinois schools. In a statement to campus, President Larry Dietz says they're also working to reduce the risk of international students being affected here by ensuring their degree programs meet the federal requirements. International students are invited to a town hall Thursday to discuss the situation. The deadline to file state and federal income tax returns is this week. IPR's Sean Crawford reports.
The deadline was extended this year because of the pandemic. Sam Salustro is a spokesman for the Illinois Department of Revenue.
Normally the tax deadline is April 15th, but it was pushed back 3 months. So this year the tax deadline is July 15th.
Despite the extra time allotted, Salustro says more than 86% of taxpayers had filed as of last week. Nearly 3.5 million refunds in Illinois have been processed. The agency is urging electronic filing and direct deposit for those getting money back. Failing to file by July 15th could lead to penalties and interest charges. I'm Sean Crawford.
And new restrictions the Illinois High School Association has placed on summer practices because of COVID-19 has put fall athletics further into question. Bloomington High School Athletic Director Tony Bauman says he felt good when the IHSA first announced Phase 4 return to play guidelines in early July.
I think there was a general level of optimism within high school coaches and I know in myself. Just the reminder of this past couple of days, I think, has made me a little bit more pessimistic and doubtful that we're going to for sure start on time with athletics.
But Bauman says he understands health and academics must come before athletics. The IHSA has limited any physical contact and won't allow schools to scrimmage other schools. Student athletes are also required to wear masks unless they're outside and are social distancing. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Ryan Denham. Coalition of public and private partners that sprang into action after the coronavirus is preparing for its next challenge. The Serving BN and Beyond Coalition started with food insecurity. I spoke to David Taylor from the United Way of McLean County for an update on that effort and the next wave of need.
We were probably at our peak during that, providing close to 10,000 grab-and-go meals on a daily basis at a variety of sites across the community, as many as 22 or 23 at times on any given day. But over the last several weeks, we've been making the concerted effort to something more sustainable. So we've partnered with the Tinnervin Family Foundation, and we're transitioning to food boxes, which will have staples in them, various groceries of different kinds that then will provide multiple meals for an individual or a family, as opposed to a grab and go that's just one meal for one person meant to be consumed right away there.
Back in May, you guys announced a housing assistance coalition pointing to a potential need of up to $2.7 million in rent, utilities, and mortgage assistance. As I understand it, you haven't seen the spike that you expected in July here, due in part to the state's eviction moratorium, moving back the end of that until July 26th. So, Pawnee Itham, you're the chair of the United Way of McLean County. What is the need that you've seen up to now on housing assistance?
We now foresee the increase to happen in August and the spike to happen in September, because it requires about 30 to 45 days for that process to work itself through. But I'll share this one thing, though, Ryan. We've been tracking, as a coalition, the call volume. So compared to the call volume and the case volume that we saw in the month of May to the month of June, we almost saw a good 80 to 90% increase in the call volume. I put an asterisk next to that, Ryan. This is very much tracking numbers by the coalition in bits and pieces. So I probably wouldn't say that's the most accurate number, but directionally, we are seeing an increase already happening. And we foresee that to only increase in the upcoming months.
So David Taylor, back to you. If food insecurity was the first wave and housing assistance was believed to be the second, what's going to be the third wave? And how big is it going to be? Are you still thinking childcare?
Well, and that's the kind of $64,000 question, I would say, in the room right now. We're planning to do some scenario, planning would be the best way to put it, with some of the school districts and with some of the daycare youth programming providers. And the intent with that is that we started gearing up the Child Care Youth Programming Coalition maybe a few weeks into late April, kind of a thing, right around that time, about halfway through what the Housing Coalition was doing. We were a little bit surprised, though, Ryan, to find out that once the economy started reopening at the end of May, that many of these places did not see a surge on demand. So in spite of probably a roughly 30% reduction in their capacity because of the COVID guidelines, the reopening guidelines, even with only 70% capacity, they found only about half of that 70% being used up. And so what we've learned anecdotally, at least, is that a lot of parents either are still working from home, so they don't require it. Some are just still uncomfortable with putting their children out in there in public. And I'll share a corollary to that with some of the school surveys. You know, so they're keeping their kids home just because they're not ready without a vaccine. And then the third are just ones that have made alternative plans. They couldn't afford to wait until the economy reopened and people figured out what was available when and where. They've either locked something in or perhaps sent them away to stay with a relative. So that towards the mid to late May, we started shifting our focus more to the long term. What are the schools going to need when it's time to reopen? And in what form are they going to reopen? And so I alluded to some of their survey work, and what they're finding, at least preliminarily, is that as much as 20% of their parents are probably not going to be comfortable putting their kids back in the school buildings in the fall if there's not a vaccine. And they've also, you know, have a sense that it's about the same for the staff, that it's about 20% of the staff that's uncomfortable with that too. I think their intent and their desire is to get particularly those fifth grade and under in the school buildings. But for junior high or high school, might, because of social distancing and some other things, might they opt for more e-learning? And as I understand it, having a 12-year-old myself in the local school systems, you know, they're asking if you're interested in doing distance learning, e-learning like that, you have to commit for the full semester. So that will help them logistically, but it'll also, if suddenly we see a spike in cases and they have to shut the schools down, are we going to be prepared? Do we have a backup or contingency plan to help support them if suddenly parents are still at work, but schools are shut down?
That's David Taylor and Pawnee Itham from the United Way of McLean County. You can get an update on the Serving BN and Beyond Coalition's efforts through a virtual town hall conducted every 2 weeks on Saturdays on the United Way's Facebook page. The murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery have renewed conversations about systemic racism and inequality in the U.S. This is a time white people can listen and learn from the lived experience of Black Americans. Dana Vollmer has a story of a Peoria bookseller who's trying to help people do just that.
Jessica Stevenson owns Lit on Fire Books on Main Street. She has created reading guides for those who want to confront their privilege and unpack their racial biases. Stevenson calls the lists anti-racist education for white people. They include biographies, historical nonfiction, essay collections, and other works by Black writers. Stevenson is white and trying to educate other white people while centering Black voices. She says she wants to encourage those who want to be better allies to do the work themselves.
A big part of choosing anti-racism is also choosing not to go to your Black friends, your Black community members, and say, hey, educate me. It is our job to use the resources that are available to us to take that burden from their shoulders and actually take time to educate ourselves.
Stevenson says Black writers have already put in the time to unpack racism, and she says there's a title for everyone, depending on how they learn best.
We know that some people learn better through empathy, so I would suggest a biography in that case, you know, something that's a firsthand account of the oppression that one person has faced. Other people will learn better by having like a workbook style kind of call to action type of reading.
Stevenson says some might do better with historical texts, but each genre provides different tools to understand racism and how to work to dismantle it. Stevenson offers a starting point for white people and even non-Black people of color who are feeling lost or anxious about jumping in.
My first suggestion is a book that hasn't been out for too long, but the movement has been around for quite a while. It's called Me and White Supremacy.
The newly published work by Layla F. Saad is a 28-day challenge to combat racism. Stevenson says it's based on Saad's Instagram initiative of the same name.
As far as quick action and easy step-by-step kind of jump in and do the book instead of read the book and just hear it, this is the book that I suggest.
Next up, she recommends the works of Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, Stamped from the Beginning, and How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Stamped from the Beginning really walks you through the history of anti-Black racism, and it doesn't shy away from, you know, internalized racism either. So for folks who really want to see how racist thought has affected the thinkers of our time, this is a great book to look into.
For a quick, impactful read, Stevenson suggests The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin.
It's short, it's heart-wrenching, it is a deep look into the life of essentially a gay Black man growing up in Harlem. It consists of two letters, and James Baldwin has a way of writing that it just grabs you. You cannot look away.
She says to then follow up with Jessamyn Ward's The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race. It's a collection of contemporary essays continuing the conversation started by Baldwin's work. These are just a few of the titles featured on the Anti-Racist Education for White People Guides. Stevenson also created lists of works by Black poets and recommendations for parents trying to teach their kids about racism. The lists are available on Lit on Fire's Facebook and Bookshop pages, but Stevenson says it's only meant to be a research tool. She says the goal is to center Black voices and businesses.
I would say if people want, they can look at my lists and then use those to write down what titles they are interested in, and then find those Black-owned bookstores that they would like to support and buy them there.
She recommends Semicolon Bookstore in Chicago as an Illinois-based option. She says many around the country sell online, though buyers might need patience.
A lot of anti-racist reading materials are back-ordered right now because the outpouring for support for Black voices and for white people who are choosing now is their time to jump in and buy the books and do the work themselves, which they should be doing, have sold out left and right. We have so many books backlogged that we can't get in stock in stores. Our warehouses are out of stock.
Stevenson says the wait is worthwhile. I'm Dana Vollmer.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM. Recent riots in Bloomington-Normal and in many states over the death of George Floyd may have something in common with the so-called race riots of the 1960s and many other outbursts throughout history. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker has more.
A lot of riots have a precipitating event, such as George Floyd's killing or the street brawl that became the 1770 Boston Massacre. Illinois Wesleyan University sociologist Todd Fuest says there's also usually an underlying social problem, such as race discrimination or British exploitation of colonists.
There's typically an existing kind of emotional store of energy around a particular issue. There's already a contingency of people who feel that there is an inequity or feel that there is a social problem that's not being addressed. And because of the stored up emotions around this particular issue, it ignites into something that from the outside might look spontaneous, but to people within often feels like it's been building for a while.
And once the fuse lights, Fuest says, events can cluster together in time.
It was often an act of solidarity almost. So something might happen in the city that's not your own, but when you'd see that there was this kind of extreme protest going on, that people feel given license to enact those kinds of protests in other places.
Most of the recent protests and demonstrations in America and Bloomington Normal have been peaceful exercises in freedom of assembly. Some have not. The peaceful protesters have sought to distinguish their actions from groups or crowds that have broken laws and damaged property. Those who minimize the national focus on police killings have sometimes tried to link peaceful and violent protesters. Historically, Fuest says, the reality can be somewhat muddy. Peaceful protests can become violent and still be protests. The participants in riots might be somewhat different, though, says Fuest.
It's largely populations who are feeling marginalized. Well, younger people often lack the institutional channels that older people have. People who are from marginalized groups, people who are poor often lack the institutional channels that people who are richer or socially dominant have.
There is a distinction between even violent protesting and looting. But Fuest says that does not mean there is no connection with peaceful protests.
Things like this happen when there's some kind of breakdown of a social script or the breakdown of social control. One of the things we tend to find in criminology, for example, is that people will do what they feel they can do with regard to illegal behavior. This is why lots of people will pirate a record online, but most of them wouldn't walk into a store and swipe a CD. You feel you can get away with the pirating the record online more because you can, effectively. At times when there is an opportunity, because there's kind of a dissolution of whatever the social script governing a particular situation is, you're more likely to see something like a riot or other kinds of extreme protest occur.
Riots, looting, and other breakdowns also tend to happen with what Fuest calls non-hierarchical organizations. If a social movement has a president or CEO and they can say, stop doing that, he says that's a situation you're less likely to see something like a riot erupt. You can think of something like the Arab Spring, Fuest says. Lots of movements don't have a specific leader or have clusters of groups in which you are more likely to see outbursts. That also makes it more difficult to see who's rioting and why. In the present moment around the nation, much of the violence has happened among younger protesters. Fuest says there are generational divides among activists. He also says other societal stresses can bear on such flare-ups.
It would not surprise me if some of what we're seeing here has to do with even something like COVID. You know, people are right now currently on edge about a number of socio-political issues. So I could imagine that given the kind of larger frustrations going on in society right now, that this was a particularly potent kind of cocktail.
Fuest says job losses and shortages and other disruptions of everyday life can also trigger movement activity. Liberals and some members of the military have pointed to President Trump's statements on race and demonstrations as another inciting factor. Fust says it is hard to say how much the way leadership responds to a historical moment can exacerbate or minimize violence.
Because it's real hard to kind of directly connect what a president said to what happens on the ground in ways that don't get methodologically slippery. There is definitely some evidence that leaders are part of promoting what is considered an acceptable response, modeling behavior for citizens, providing either that sense of social control or the breakdown of the social script.
Fust says a larger finding is that perceptions of weak leadership or divisions among leadership tend to cause more aggressive social movement activity. In the case of weak leadership, the perception is that activists think they won't have effective opposition. In the case of divided leadership, the perception is that allies might be available. I'm Charles Schlenker.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. John Finley came north during the Great Migration. Today, Finley shares part of his life sharecropping and growing up in the South for WGLT's series Living Black in Bloomington Normal. Finley tells WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell about the impact of the KKK on his family. It starts with how African Americans were treated in the Southern workforce before the Civil Rights Movement.
It's a layered chain. They treat us like a dog. That's how they was treating us, and they worked us like a dog. But we worked, and we tried to, smile and still be good, But they really did us bad. I never was prejudiced myself. Mm-hmm. Never was really prejudiced, but it was a lot of white people that I didn't like, that I still don't like. But, I know prejudice wasn't the thing.
You mentioned that, we mentioned work and how they, kind of worked you like a dog. Like, what was that work experience like?
Yeah, it was in Tupelo, Mississippi, in Jackson, Tennessee. It was a lot of little towns that I lived in, I can't remember, Everywhere I went, it was prejudice. My job was feeding animals, cows, picking cotton, doing all that stuff. Anything that you do on the farm, I did it.
Do you know, like what year, like specific year or years or like time frame this was?
It started in 59. It went all up. It was up to 68. That's when it started. And I was doing something everything. We were like the crew. We worked. We couldn't go to school like we really wanted to, but we went to school trying to make it.
The farm you worked at, was that a family farm?
The guy would rent us the farm. We would raise stuff on the farm, and he get half of it. He didn't do nothing, but he got half of whatever we got off the farm. They gave us a big farm, We had a big farm, and we worked it.
And John, I think that Shia mentioned that you had a relative that was actually encountered by the KKK, who was had a very heavily presence in the South during that time. Like, talk about that situation and just kind of, how that impacted you or how you saw racism at that time.
Okay, the experience with the KKK was, I knew him, but, I didn't mess around with my dad, And my dad, he got, put down for real bad. He jumped on him about something, and they cut his throat, and they beat him, stabbed him, they did everything to him. They killed him. I just don't know. After that, I don't know.
Do you know, what led up to that moment? Like, how did that even happen?
Something he did. He did to them. Because they were doing the same thing to him, back and forth. He did something to them. It was three or four of them at one time. He got it. He killed it. That was it.
And how did you find out about that?
Well, I found out about it. I think it was the next day. I was in Chicago, and he was in Jackson, Tennessee. Somebody had told my mother or somebody. I heard about it right away.
Growing up, how did your parents ever talk to you about how to navigate society, with racism going on and being black?
Because it wasn't really too much to talk about, so all the kids that was growing up knew. They knew better. They knew what was happening. They weren't out there being like no little puppy dogs, but they knew what was going on.
The owners of the farm that rented to your family, they were white. Did you guys ever have, like, that conversation about, like, you know, the racial tensions and everything going on?
Never did. Never heard no kind of racist. But see, where they were, it was people that we was around, and, you know, they was white people. Yeah, at least you could come in. They come out and pick at us about our fields. So we had our fields growing so nice. And they couldn't grow now like that. You know, they always criticize and stuff, but they kind of stayed the ground and stuff, you know.
What would they say?
They weren't going to come through with no bop. We just threw it right back at them.
That's John Finley, speaking with student reporter Darnisha Mitchell for this episode of the WGLT series, Living Black in Bloomington Normal. You can find the rest of the series at wglt.org/livingblack. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories. You're listening to WGLT Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Marketplace is coming up next.